global symmetries of physical dynamical theories and conserved quantities. And we were looking at the logic of Noether's first theorem and some simple applications in quantum mechanics and electrodynamics. When I came to the perimeter, I was very interested to see that there was work going on in applying Noether's first theorem to quantum field theory, where things become much, much more complicated, and to the theory of doubly special relativity. And I thought it would be very useful if we had some remarks today from Michele Arzano about this development, about this relatively recent development. So what I propose to do is to ask Michele to speak for about 20 minutes about this aspect of Noether's first theorem. We'll see. I don't know how I'm going to control you when it comes to discussion. So we'll have something like 10 minutes of discussion after Michele's contribution. Then I'll come back and talk about Noether's second theorem. That's to say, the identities that arise from Noether's variational condition, which hold for local symmetries, such as diffeomorphism invariance in general relativity. Then we'll have a small break, and then I'll make a few more remarks about the second theorem before we finish with a general discussion. So it's really a pleasure for me to have Michele here inside my own lecture. Does everyone knows Michele? Do I have to introduce him? I think Michele needs no introduction.
Okay, thanks, Harvey. Thanks a lot. And thanks for giving me this opportunity to talk about some of my actual recent work and research. Okay, so first of all, a disclaimer. I only have 4 slides, so I will be very qualitative and very sloppy for those of you who know these topics. For those of you who do not know these topics, maybe this will be, hopefully not, but probably will be too technical. I don't know, just stop me whenever you want and ask questions about notations you don't understand and so on. So first of all, let me say something about what happens if we try to translate Noether's theorem literally from the framework of classical field theory to quantum field theory. And okay, the first thing and the main problem is that fields in quantum field theory are not our usual functions. They're just what we call operator valued distributions. So for those of you who do not know, one venerable example of distribution is Dirac's delta function. Distributions are not functions. They make sense only when integrated together with a real function, when smeared. And so fields in quantum field theory, in order to make sense as operator on a Hilbert space, they need to be smeared with functions, and so on and so forth. So if we just try to repeat the steps of the proofs of both first Noether's theorem and the converse, we have problems. We have problems because all the manipulations, all the mathematical manipulations we do when we're proving these theorems involve, for example, taking the product of two distributions and much more complicated. There are other things that we do not know how to deal with. Actually, for example, the product of two distributions is not well defined. Nobody knows how to take the product of two deltas, for example. And in particular, imagine we have our classical conserved current, J mu. In the quantum field realm, this becomes an operator value distribution. So I put the hat up there. And if we try to define the conserved charge, Q, integrating over all space, I'm in the 3+1 dimension, OK? 3 spatial one-time dimensions of our real world as we see it. Well, this object doesn't make any sense. It's not a well-defined operator, like written this way. Doesn't make any sense. In fact, I mean, actually, after a lot of work in axiomatic quantum field theory in the 60s, we still do not have a rigorous formulation of Noether's theorem in axiomatic quantum field theory. You can see this. There's a this very nice monography by Lopusansky, which I'm going to cite at the end, the bibliography. So if a quantile version of Noether's first theorem does not exist, we can still do something with the converse of Noether's theorem in a quantum field theory framework. In fact, a lot of work during the 60s by all these people working in axiomatic quantum field theory, they put a lot of effort trying to prove a quantile version of the converse of Noether's theorem. And in fact, we do have the converse of Noether's theorem in quantum field theory. And this is, here is the statement that the charge, we can actually manage to define a charge Q, not in this way, but appropriately smearing this operator and taking some appropriate limits. The charge we will be able to define from here then defines a one-parameter continuous group of similar transformations of our quantum fields. And let me be a little bit more specific here. My second slide. A key result in proving the converse of Noether's theorem in quantum field theory is a theorem due to Kassler, Robison, and Spica, 1966. And it actually tells you that starting from a locally conserved current, and local here means local with respect to the current and the fields, so that their commutator at space-like separation vanishes. So by locality here, roughly speaking, I mean this, when x and y are space-like separated. Okay. So and this holds with also between the charges themselves. Okay, this is what I mean by local. So given this object, these guys here were able to actually construct a well-defined charge operator. As I said, appropriately smearing this charge and taking the right limit and so on. You have to be very careful in manipulating these objects, but they actually managed to do it. And this charge operator Q hat defines a symmetry generator G whose action on this state of the Hilbert space is given by the commutator between Q and the field phi. Okay? So we do have a way of relating a conserved current to a symmetry generator, and this is actually the way we actually realize the converse of Noether's theorem in quantum field theory. And why are we so interested in defining properly the action of a symmetry generator in quantum field theory? Well, turns out that the Hilbert space of states for a general free quantum field is defined as a representation of the group of symmetry of Minkowski space. Okay, Poincaré group. And so you see that it's crucial to be able to describe the generators of Poincaré group or Poincaré algebra in terms of the basic objects of the theory, which are the fields themselves. In some way, it's a sort of self-consistency check. You know what I'm saying? I'm like the Hilbert space, which is defined as a representation, but then what if I'm not able to actually describe the generators of this group of symmetries itself using the fields? So things have to match in some way. And here's the process. I start, for example, from the stress energy tensor. From the stress energy tensor, I construct the conserved charge. And this charge generates the algebra of translation symmetries generator. And then from this, I can describe the states of my free field as field modes. These are essential objects that we deal with every day when we do quantum field theory. Okay, so if we want to be a little sloppier, and we do not want to deal with all the machinery of axiomatic quantum field theory, there are path integrals, which are a beautiful, nice way to see many things you do not see in a canonical setting or in an axiomatic setting. And in fact, path integral techniques offer a very nice alternative way to discuss symmetries in quantum field theory. In fact, you can derive a very beautiful set of identities which involve the conserved current J, the field phi, and the symmetry generator G. And these identities are known as word identities. And so let's look for a second and at this expression here. This means here, these brackets here mean that we are taking the vacuum expectation value of the time order product of the time order product of these objects. These are called correlation functions and are essential in scattering theory, quantum field theory. And on this other side, this is again a time order product of these objects. And here, the generator, symmetry generator G, is acting on the field with the argument xi. And the word identities, as we will see in the next slide, actually are a very useful tool to go through these steps. But they also contain much more. They're beautiful. They're very general. They hold at all orders in perturbation theory. And they also are an invaluable tool for understanding this beautiful phenomena known as anomalies in quantum field theory. So when you start from classical symmetry and you quantize the system and you lose the symmetry, these are very nice and interesting phenomena in quantum field theory. And what we've seen so far was pretty much standard stuff. Now let's get to the fun. And the first surprises here happen when we go to lower dimensional quantum field theories. And before diving into the dimensional quantum field theory, let me notice that if I integrate the word identity as in the previous slide, so over a volume which contains the point x prime, and this is the boundary of this volume, for a local current, this integral, you can go ahead and do the calculations yourself, or if you don't want, you can just look at the book of conformal field theory by Mathieu and DiFrancesco. It's going to be in the bibliography. For a local current, this integral here just gives back your standard commutator action that we saw some slide ago, the KRS action. However, this formula here, this way of writing the action of the symmetry generator in terms of the component of the conserved current is much more general. And in fact, let's go to 1+1 dimensional quantum field theory. There's a wide family of what we call integrable models, because these are completely solvable models of quantum field theory. We actually exhibit some non-local conserved currents, actually an infinite family of non-local conserved currents. By non-local, I mean that this is now no longer valid, so that we have this. And during the 90s, people started like dealing with these objects. And the standard tools of Lie algebras, standard tools of, essentially Lie algebras, weren't enough to actually completely understand what is going on with these non-local currents. So to make the long story short, I'm not going to go into any detail. You can look at the papers. But essentially, the non-local conserved currents in 1+1-dimensional quantum field theory are associated with charge generators, which do not act according to the standard commutator, but according to what we call the braided commutator. See, this is the braiding matrix. If this theta here is equal to 1, you recover the standard commutator action. However, in general, in these models, this theta is not equal to 1. And here's a little pictorial representation of what's going on here. Essentially, the problem is that these non-local currents are non-local because in order to define them, you need to attach a string that goes from the point where you evaluate the current all the way down to minus infinity. This is space, and this is time in this pictures. And you see very qualitatively that there is, if you define your field at the point y, then there is a topological obstruction if you want to move the string through the field. Again, I don't have enough time, so I'm not going to explain what are these pictures exactly, but just to give you like a nice pictorial view of what's going on. It turns out that this action here is something we do not know how to interpret in the framework of the algebras. In fact, people realized in the 90s that these QAs do not generate a standard Lie group, but what we call a quantum group. And as generators, they do not close a Lie algebra, but they close what we call off algebra, which is a much more general structure, much more complicated, but also with lots of interesting features. Indeed, all the information that we have in the non-trivial algebraic structure of these non-local charges is enough. You have so much information, it's enough to reconstruct the full S matrix of these integrable models. So to actually solve the full theory. This is a step forward from standard classical field theory and other theory. Now we have the conserved charges, you have some symmetries, you have the conserved charges, and then you know the whole theory, the whole thing, the whole story. And this is pretty beautiful, like, from my point of view at least. Okay, this is just like, let's say, not very realistic models for our everyday life, yes.
Any theory, doesn't matter what action you write down.
Mm-hmm. No, there is a class of models. It's not any 1+1. There's a specific class of models that you can see. There's a paper I'm going to mention in the bibliography where all this class, these families of 1+1-dimensional quantum theory are classified. And for each one, you have a specific algebraic structure. So it's not all of it.
So it's basically just using the word entity for this type of.
Yeah, essentially at the end of the day, the way you write down this action here is just really starting from the word identity. And integrating word identity in 1+1 dimensions means doing this integral here. So doing this integral, if you go to 1+1 dimensions, means imagine this y is your x prime. And this, the boundary here is this contour. Okay. But then, as I said, the current here needs to be attached minus infinity. So you split this integral in two parts. One part is up here, and it gives you just this standard contribution. And you see, when you have this second contribution here, you have the string attached minus infinity. In order to evaluate this integral, you need to move the string down here. And moving the string to the point y gives you this braiding contribution. But yeah, everything comes from the word that it is.
But why is it a topological obstruction?
I call it topological obstruction. It's just basically.
Polling the integral?
Huh?
Is it a polling the integral?
It's not really a polling the integral. It's the fact that when you want to, basically doing the integral, you want to move phi to the left of j. And when you're going to move phi to the left of j, you get a non-trivial commutator, which gives you this non-trivial phrase. And pictorially, this can be seen as moving that string to the point y.
Michele, can I just ask a question?
Sure.
Am I right in thinking that the Ward identity is an identity because it holds both on-shell and off-shell? Why is it called identity?
Because it is an equal sign.
Why is it called a Ward equation? I mean, identity usually means something that holds off-shell as well as on-shell.
I think this one, I might be wrong, but I think it holds on-shell. Because all the stuff you have here, it's on shell.
The reason I'm asking is that if it holds both on shell and off shell, then it's hard to see how you get a conserved current. Because, I mean, in the standard Noether theorem, you start with an identity which is given to you by the Noether condition, which follows from the existence of a symmetry. But in order to get a conserved charge, you need to go on shell.
Yeah, but I think this holds on shell.
I expect hold on shell.
Yeah, I mean.
But exclusively on shell?
You see, these guys here, these time-ordered vacuum expectation values are, you can define them only for the asymptotic fields. You know, you can write this down for a full interacting theory, but essentially, I guess this is just essentially on shell.
Okay.
But if someone knows better than me, it's...
Give me the answer.
Huh?
I think the word identities are two also.
Yes, the audience is more.
There's an expectation value there. There's an expectation value. So
yes.
It's be integrated over all fields of operations.
So, okay, so then we won't know what we're meaning by on shell or off shell.
It's going to depend on whether you're talking about.
I'm talking about
the model, right? The model is going to have a different Hilbert space than this applied in the normal textbook formulation.
Which model is
applied? So the solved model is going to have.
Sure.
So the vectors.
No, but then so your question was about in general for the Ward identity or just for the 1+1 dimensional model?
No, in general.
Okay. Okay. What do you mean by off shell?
So for any configuration of external fields.
Yes.
On or off shell, this identity will hold.
Good.
What I'm talking is like, by on shell, I mean that this guy in momentum space are on the hyperbola.
What I claim is that it holds even if the external.
So it means you think. Well, but these are unphysical things, you know.
It might be unphysical, but it's an identity.
In a loop, like you take fields in a loop and you like do the thing and then it holds the same.
Yeah, because this deposits on what? It deposits on a change of variables in the function integral.
Yeah.
And then, as it is a change of variable, you just impose that the function integral will not vary with this change of variable.
Yeah.
And this is something which is true on shell or off shell. It's only a stupid change of variable from the integral.
Yeah, sure. But, okay, then.
Can you someone translate what he's saying?
Yeah.
So, slowly. I don't think it's on shell or off shell.
Yeah.
So, on shell, by the way, is just satisfying the equation.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, but.
Just like
your Noether
theorem, is it?
Yes.
No, it's a conservation.
That's why I said, I'm not sure, but that's why what we were trying to say, yeah.
Maybe we can come back. We can come back to this.
Okay, so let's see. Do we have something similar happening in our more familiar 3+1 dimensional quantum field theory? And here I'm going to be very sloppy, so don't get mad, please. So yes, that's the question. So could something similar to this two-dimensional case happen to more familiar currents, like for example, energy momentum tensor in 3+1 dimensions? Well, and there are some experts in the audience, namely Bianca Dietrich, who's been working on this too. Let's say that there is a common belief in the quantum gravity community that if you want to define your quantum field theory observables starting from a theory which contains quantum gravity and quantum fields themselves, then you take the limit the low energy limit. So you turn, you're like about to turn off gravity. And what you recover are not your familiar local observables of quantum field theory, but there is some residual non-locality for these objects here, defined through this limit. And well, it seems like, in a very loosely speaking, there is a treatment similar to the two-dimensional case for the charges associated to the space-time symmetries. And this will bring you from the usual framework of the Poincaré-Lie algebra, for example, to the framework of a deformed Poincaré algebra, which we call kappa Poincaré, which is actually not a Lie algebra anymore, but it's Opf algebra. And the algebraic tools we introduce here are the ones that are needed to handle this non-locality. And as in the previous case, there's lots of structure here. And this structure allows you to introduce an observer-independent length or masses minus one scale. This is actually mass, like dimension, kappa, which we usually put set at the Planck energy, 10 to 19 GeV, yes.
Is there like an easy way to see the difference, just explain the difference between the Hopf algebra and the algebra?
Okay, in one word, Hopf algebras have built in the way you build tensor product representation, while Poincaré, while the algebras do not. So you start from a representation of a Lie algebra, and in order to define tensor products of this representation, you need to introduce some assumptions by hand. While instead, the Hopf algebraic structure contains a sector which is called the coalgebra sector, which is telling you how to define this tensor product representation, and it's built in. That's the main thing I say. Right, there's much more for us. Okay, and this is like, it has been known now since 2001, work by Giovanni Amelino Camelia, that introduces, so Kappa Poincaré was essentially used as a tool of introducing the observer-independent length scale, and he dubbed this doubly specialty PSR. So essentially, he's saying usual relativity, special relativity symmetry generators belong to Lie algebra. Now I'm going to make it double. I'm going to use one more observer-independent scale with respect to the standard speed of light, and then I'm going to make doubly special. But essentially, what it boils down is just to use Kappa Poincaré algebra instead of standard Lie algebra. And then here, the converse of Snedder's theorem comes back again. And actually, it is of crucial importance now, because it allows us to characterize the deformed generators of the Kappa Poincaré algebra, for example, the translation generators, which I call P kappa mu, in terms of conserved charges, Q mu kappa, which are written in terms of the fields. And this is crucial, why? Because then these P mu's, described by these charges here, describe the deformed, sorry, I said described like 200 times in 1 minute. This describes a deformed Hilbert space for our quantum fields. And this Hilbert space turns out to have a much richer structure than the Hilbert space of usual local quantum field theory, even in the free field case. And it's beautiful, complex structure, which is actually subject of my current research right now. And in particular, like two things I want to mention and some work in progress with Dr. Benedetti here in the audience, understanding the statistics underlying these kappa particles described by this strange Hilbert space. And some work with Alyosha Amma and Simone Severini, people working mainly in quantum information, about the consequence of this Hilbert space structure could have, like, for black hole information paradox. And let me thank you for your attention, and here's some bibliography in case you want to go a little deeper into these topics. Thank you.
Yeah, I just had a quick question about, do you know if this, by extending the space, space-time, if you actually avoid the null theorem or it's violated?
Okay, so one of the assumptions of Kolarov-Mann Nulla theory is that Sibri generators, in general, okay, let me see it here. For example, Sibri generators for translations act in an additive way on tensor product of filter spaces. Let me make it more clear. Imagine you have n particle filter space. Roughly speaking, it's a tensor product of many representations. And let's say we have an element of this filter space. Okay. This should be symmetrized in case of bosons and energized in case of fermions, but we're not saying about this now. One of the assumptions of Kolarov-Mann Nulla theorem is that when you act the translation symmetry generator of this guy, you can write down this action as simply as a derivative action. So first, this guy acts on first state and not on the other ones, okay? Then it acts on second state and leaves alone on the other one and so on, okay? This is so-called Leibniz rule. This is an assumption. Turns out that what you're doing here is exactly what you're doing with op algebras, or with this kind of op algebra, is exactly playing around with the Leibniz rule. So this action, okay, just one more thing. This action here, the standard Leibniz rule in terms of op algebra structure, is defined by something that we call the coproduct. On a two-particle state, this guy is telling you that this p mu is acting as a derivative. That's first on the first, then on the second. In Kappa-Valkyrie, for example, for the translation generators, this guy is deformed in this way. Instead of the identity here, you have an exponential function of the time translation generator. So you see, one of the assumptions of the Kolarov-Mann Nulla theorem is dead. And so, yeah.
It's probably just the assumption of locality.
And it is related to the assumption of locality, in fact. Yes?
Maybe for the sake of the spirit of this series of discussions, it'd be useful to talk about the kind of difficulties of interpreting these deformed actions as symmetries due to their non-linearities.
The difficulties?
The difficulty interpreting them not as.
Oh, yeah, I mean, this is.
Due to their. I mean, would you give us a snapshot of what are the new difficulties so that then. I don't know.
Yeah, so
this is interesting.
Okay, so and now I wrote it down just like the what happens in generative translation, but here we have the full Poincaré algebra right here in the game.
That gets non-linear.
Yeah, that gets non-linear. So you have translation generators, codation generators, and everything gets terribly messier than standard Poincaré algebra. And when you write down, so there are still issues going on here. When you write down the hyperspace, which respect this strange structure for the coproduct,
I'm just getting
there. Yeah, I know. there are some issues. When you write down the hyperspace, which is compatible with the structure of this p mu case, then there are some issues in checking if this hyperspace is compatible with actually the full set of generators of Kappa-Valkyrie. Yeah, this is one of the issues going on.
You see, Harvey, that seemingly harmless generalization there from an interpretation of physical interpretation as many considerations. You cannot really separate anymore. No, an independent identification of one sector and the other sector, because they are non-linearly mixed.
But yeah, also many nice constants. Like, for example, one nice constant. Yeah. You start like with two field modes, say P1 and P2. For usual bosons, a state which I, okay, now maybe I take too much time, but essentially now in this case, if you want to make a two-particle state out of these two modes, now you'll have a splitting. Instead of having usually one particle state, you have P1, P2, which is essentially this guy here, P1 tensor P2 plus P2 tensor P1. This is your standard two-particle state in scalar, for a scalar boson, whatever. And then if you permute the order of these two guys, so you get the same state. In our case, no, just because this state here has to be an eigenvalue of P mu, and you can go on and see that
there is not anymore.
Yes, this one is not anymore an eigenvalue of this guy, so there are other eigenvalues, but this nice, the nice feature is that that's the extra structure you get. That, you know.
Is this related to the claim in doubly special relativity that a boost will also introduce a rotation?
Yeah, in fact, this is one of the problems you run into when you want to study like the covariance property of this new Hilbert space. It's something that you don't know.
That should be ultimately testable.
Well, you know, think that this deformation parameter here, you see, it depends on the ratio of P0 over kappa. P0 is the energy, kappa is the Planck energy. So as long as you stay like in infrared, this is basically negligible. But, well, this is an assumption. You say like I'm deforming this guy, essentially because if you want to see this thing as coming from like a context which has gravity into like that's the natural scale. This is just cheap.
Can I have a question?
Yes.
So the concept charges and the generators of symmetries and so on, they are defined starting from the correlation functions in the word identity.
No.
How do you define them in C++?
How do you define? Okay. So basically, historically, people just started with the algebra, Poincaré's algebra, and actually they actually did classical field theory with that, and they did, and then we did like a nether analysis using classical fields with this quantum symmetries, which is a little bit of a toy model. But that's,
so you haven't tried to really quantify this
model? No. Then, more recently, you just go ahead, go for a free scalar field, you can start from the classical field theory, quantize the classical field theory using symplectic geometry tools, and you can actually, from the standard conserved charges in terms of the classical fields, you can write conserved charges.
For a free field.
And you haven't
tried
for interacting.
No.
Okay, can I just ask a question? Sure. You started off by saying that, you know, you have a problem in quantum field theory with the whole node of theorem. You've got these, you know, smeared distribution, operator valued fields, and so on. But that, insofar as you could define a conserved charge, it was the inverse node of theorem that seemed to be the relevant.
Yeah.
Okay. So in other words, you're going from the conserved charge to a symmetry. But when you introduced the Ward identity, when you did introduce the Ward identity, it looked, roughly speaking, as if you were using the normal. I mean, the logic seemed to be closer to the normal node of theorem. That's to say, you start with an identity that has something to do with symmetries, but then you derive the existence of.
Well, you don't start with the Ward identity. You derive the Ward identity from the path integral of the theory. And that's
and symmetries aren't involved in that direction.
Oh yeah. So okay. Yes, the word entity comes from the symmetry, right. The symmetries of the classical action.
Right. So
classical action is in your path integral, and then yes.
So the standard node of theorem does seem to be playing a role here, at least the spirit of the standard Noether theorem seems
to be. Sure, the derivation of the word entity, yes, you're using it, yeah.
I'm just going to, along the same lines, ask if moving to the path integral framework, there was some hope that you would be able to get the original direction of Noether's theorem as well, or if it's...
Well, okay, from my point of view, the big problem with the original... the Noether theorem, not the converse, is that essentially there... It's like going from global to local, okay? You know what I'm saying? And quantum field theory is intrinsically local. Makes sense, right? Everything is based on combination relations and so on, like at least in the axiomatic framework. That's why people have had so many problems in trying to put the direct Noether theorem. I don't see how we could actually, I don't know, maybe like, on the same lines of when you prove like word identity, you actually try to find in some way to play around and say something in that direction, but not where on the, maybe someone else who's more expert in this kind of stuff. I think the main issue that way is like, in some way, going local to global in quantum field theory is okay, in some very controlled way. The other way around seems to be much more troublesome.
Well, Michele, thank you very much again for
thank
the
you, Arvind. Thanks a lot.
Okay, it's a 11:45, and I'd like to speak, say, for 20 minutes or something like 20 minutes, 25 minutes, then we'll have a break, then I'll finish the discussion of the second theorem. Here's another couple of photos of Noether. Were any of you not at the first lecture that I gave in this course? Okay, well, I'll repeat the story that Lee Smolin told me. Apologies to those who have heard it before. When Noether died prematurely and tragically in 1935, an international conference was held in her honor, and Hermann Weyl made this remark that Emmy Noether was not made of clay, etc., but rather a chunk of human primary rock to which she had blown. God had blown his creative breath of life. Well, Einstein apparently got up and said, you're not exactly beautiful either, Mr. Weyl. Noether's life, there's a rotating button, but I think I'm going to use, I'll stick with this one for the moment. At the age of 18, after high school, Noether would have normally gone into school teaching, along with most women who are interested in science. You couldn't matriculate into a course in Germany at the time. You couldn't become a university student. But she audited courses. She was brought up in Erlangen, but she was audited courses in Göttingen, but eventually was able to do studies in Erlangen. And in 1908, at the age of 26, she was awarded a doctorate in mathematics. Working in algebra being the field that ultimately she made her name in mathematics, much more famous in mathematics than in physics. But David Hilbert was interested in certain problems related to general relativity. Hilbert was following Einstein's work extremely carefully. In fact, there is something of a dispute in the literature about who got the field equations first. It's now pretty clear it was Einstein. But for a long time, it was felt that if it wasn't a draw, then Hilbert got the field equations first. There's an interesting recent historical development about this. Maybe I can come back to that later. But at any rate, David Hilbert, one of the greatest mathematicians of the age, was very interested in the developments in a geometrical theory of gravitation, but was puzzled by certain aspects related to conservation principles. And this was connected with the fact that you could derive the field equations by way of a variational principle, where the action itself was diffeomorphically invariant. And Hilbert suspected that some of the peculiarities of the conservation principles in general relativity, or rather the lack thereof, was connected with diffeomorphism invariance, general covariance, to speak generally. He realized, and Klein also at the time was Felix Klein was very interested in this, and Noether was known to be an expert on the variational calculus, so they invited Noether to Göttingen, and she, for some years there she taught and worked on this variational problem. Her lectures were unpaid. I'm mentioning all of this because I wanted to mention a story. Hilbert himself was trying very, very hard to get Noether onto the faculty, to get her a proper paid job. And he took it to the university council, and there was a discussion at the council. The proposal was refused. And he famously remarked to the men in the council, "Gentlemen, this is not a bathhouse. We could have women on the faculty." But it took some time before she did get an official recognized appointment. I think this only occurred in 1922. But it was even later still that she got anything like a salary. Oh, I think that could, in England, they could vote. I think so. I think by 1920, I forget when emancipation
Germany, right?
Yeah. This is all happening.
Oh, Gilbert, I thought it was the English, it was the council you were talking about, it was the England.
No, this is all taking place in the University of Göttingen.
So the council of the German.
Yeah. At any rate, in 1933, which I think is the year that Einstein also was driven out of Germany, in 1933, Emmy Noether left Germany for the United States. She eventually got a job at Bryn Mawr College, but she died as the result of complications of an operation in 1935. Now, we saw last time that if you impose symmetries, that's to say, variations of the independent and dependent variables, both the space-time variables and the field variables, specific symmetries, and you demand that under those variations, the action is invariant up to a surface time, then you end up getting a condition, let's call it the Noether condition, which is broken up into an interior phi, which is a linear combination of the Euler expressions, where the coefficients are these Lie drags of the fields under the variations. And then this boundary term, I'm saying it's a boundary term because, of course, it's a total divergence. And inside the integral, of course, when one's integrating in the action principle, this becomes a boundary term because of Gauss's theorem. And this C here just represents the facts that we're generalizing on Noether's original theorem, and we're allowing not for the variation of the action to vanish, but we're allowing it to vanish up to a surface term. And this just reflects the fact that everyone knows that a Lagrangian density in field theory is only defined up to a total divergence. That variational principle now just allows for this. And Noether was aware of this, but she didn't actually introduce it in the original paper. Now, in the case of the first theorem, we were considering variations or transformations of the coordinates and the fields, which depended on constant parameters, some number, let's say capital N, of constant parameters. So we were looking at cases like rigid translations in space, or rigid rotations in space, or boosts, all of which depend on a certain number of fixed parameters that they themselves don't depend on space and time. So they're so-called global symmetries. And we saw how they gave rise, in general, most of the time, at least, to conserved quantities on shell. So we could use this Noether condition. We could use the fact that we had a number of independent constant parameters. And out of all of this, once we were on shell, so that the Euler expressions vanish, we end up with the total divergence of some current is equal to zero, and that eventually, with the appropriate boundary conditions, gives us a conserved charge. But now let's suppose, for the sake of argument, we generalize this, and we allow that the variations in the coordinates and in the fields now depend on some arbitrary functions of space and time. So we've got rho of these arbitrary functions. And this, the special case in question that we'll be interested in is just diffeomorphisms in space-time. We allow for arbitrary smooth variations in the coordinate system, in the coordinates, which will then, of course, induce variations in the fields, because the fields will be components of tensorial objects, and of course, they transform. The very definition of these objects is that they transform in a special way under coordinate transformations. Now, let's, when we write down, we're not concerned at the moment as to how, what form these coordinate transformations take in relation to these, into these arbitrary fields. We're interested, because actually the term in question, this term here, we're going to end up ignoring. I'll say why in a minute. What we're really interested in are these form variations in this term of the fields, and we're going to say that they're linear in these functions, and the coefficients are going to be given by these AKI numbers, and also linear in the first derivatives of these fields. And we're going to assume that we can always write the form variation in this form without appealing to higher derivatives. And in standard cases, that will be the case. So I'm just saying we can now write these form variations of the fields linearly in the fields and in their first derivatives. Okay? Now, the arbitrariness in the fields, that's to say these variations depend on arbitrary fields, allow us to choose the Fs in such a way that the boundary term vanishes. So let's assume that the Fs, the variation in the Fs, that's to say we choose variations such that this term here, the integral of this term here, when we go back to the total integration, will vanish. This is very much like what we do in Hamilton's principle, by the way, when we introduce variations that vanish on the boundary. We're always allowed to do this. We could also have chosen our fields, these arbitrary fields, in such a way as to make the interior vanish. And then we get another set of identities. Remember that these things hold off shell. We haven't imposed the Euler-Lagrange conditions that make these Euler expressions equal to zero. So this is all off shell. And that's what we mean by an identity. That's why I was asking the question about the Ward identity. This has got nothing to do with on shell. On shell meaning that all the field equations are valid. All the Euler expressions are zero. So we're going to choose our Fs such that the boundary terms vanish, which means that this term now, if we put this expression for the form variations of the fields into our Noether condition, a little bit of algebra allows us to infer that this linear combination of the Euler expressions, here the coefficients correspond to the coefficients associated with the fields themselves in the form variation, is equal to a total divergence of another linear combination of the Euler expressions, where now the coefficients here are these coefficients here. And you might say, so what? Let's call these the generalized Bianchi identities. But these are constraints on the field equations. And amongst other things, they're telling you that not all of the field equations are independent. Not all of the field equations can be independent, because now we have an additional constraint on these Euler expressions that comes from the existence of this kind of symmetry, which depends on this kind of local symmetry for the action. Now, a few words about general relativity, because just before I stop, I'll show you how to apply the second theorem in general relativity. But just to remind you, if you take the vacuum solutions, the vacuum case, no matter, Hilbert introduced, as you well know, the Lagrangian density given by R, the Ricci scalar, times the square root of minus g, where g is the determinant of the metric. Wheeler, in his book, in Misenthorne and Wheeler, I think it's in Misenthorne and Wheeler, you'll find a wonderful expression. Given that the vacuum field equations follow from a variational principle based on that Lagrangian density, Wheeler said, general relativity is space-time trying to straighten itself out. Because that's the Ricci, that's the curvature scalar, and we're looking at Hamilton's principle defined with respect to variations in G mu and U, or the inverse of G mu and U with respect to that Lagrangian density. So general relativity is just space-time trying to straighten itself out. It's a wonderful phrase. You couldn't think of anything simpler. This is just a scalar density, obviously diffeomorphically invariant because this thing is a scalar. So we know that this is going to, we know that the field equations are going to be invariant under arbitrary coordinate transformations. We can see straight away. And remember last time I mentioned the really the importance of symmetries, the asymmetry between symmetries and conserved quantities in Noether's first theorem was the fact that when you look at the Lagrangian, that the action, the Lagrangian density, in some cases you can see the symmetry straight away. The symmetries are worn on the sleeve of the action. And that's why we often go from symmetries to conserved quantities and not the other way around. But now there is a puzzle here, and I'm sure that many of you are familiar with this. R is second order in derivatives of G mu and U. So how come the field equations aren't fourth order? How come they're second order? Isn't that kind of mysterious? Normally, if you have a Lagrangian density that's second order in the fields, second order derivatives of the fields, you expect to get fourth order field equations, not second order. So this must be a very special kind of thing. And it turns out that we can come up with a second Lagrangian density, which is just the Hilbert Lagrangian density up to a total divergence. Now, I've mentioned before that the Lagrangian densities are only defined up to a divergence. Lagrangians are only defined up to a divergence. So in principle, you should be able to find another Lagrangian density for general relativity, which is not won't be a scalar density, by the way. It won't be itself diffeomorphically invariant. But it would be nice if all the second order terms inside the Hilbert action ended up in that divergence term. So if you subtracted the divergence term from the Hilbert action, you get an action that was now first order. And that would explain why the field equations are only second order. And what is that Lagrangian density? It's exactly the Einstein density, which he had introduced in 1915 and 1916. Now, why did Einstein do that? Well, there's a wonderful recent paper by Michel Janssen and Jürgen Renn on the emergence of Einstein's field equations. I mean, an enormous amount of very, very good historical work has been done recently by groups of historians that are around, that are connected with the Einstein Archives Project. You'll remember that in electromagnetism, the Lagrangian density is just F mu and U, F mu and U. And so Einstein was thinking, well, wouldn't it be nice if we had something similar in GR? And he realized, for all kinds of reasons, that what was going to play the role of the F mu nu here is a three-index object. And in 1913, he chose this object, which would then plug into the analogous Lagrangian density to the electromagnetic Lagrangian density. But in 1915, he realized that this was the wrong geometric object. This is not a tensor. He should have chosen the Christoffel symbol. In other words, this is the usual connection So when you put the connection into this formula, you end up getting the Einstein Lagrangian density, and this is widely referred to as the gamma-gamma Lagrangian density in arbitrary coordinates. By the way, originally he was using these unimodular coordinates. This is gauge fixing. I'll come back to that later. But in the, for arbitrary coordinates, here is the Einstein gamma-gamma action, and it is just the Hilbert action minus a divergence term. But this is first order, because the connection terms involve first order derivatives of the metric. And so this is a nice way of understanding how it is that the Hilbert action, despite being second order, gives rise only to second order field equations, not fourth order field equations. Because it's really the Einstein action hidden by way of an extra divergence term. Yeah.
You have to invert G to get it in terms of gamma. Or do you treat them as separate?
No. You don't treat them as, they're not independent variables. You vary with respect, actually you vary with respect to the inverse of G. Okay, it's not like the Palatini action. You're not varying them independently. You could if you wanted to. But then it would just turn out, like in the Palatini case, that the, one of the field equations would be that the covariant derivative of G mean U vanishes. But that just means that this is the Christofferson. Okay. So just that little aside. And incidentally, because I'm going to come back and look at the Noether theorem, for either of these two actions, it doesn't matter because the Noether theorem is defined up to a divergence. And I'd just like to mention that when it comes to trying to derive these these action principles, or the form of the action, there's a theorem by Lovelock who pointed out that if you have a space-time that's four or less dimensions, and you want a strictly invariant action, which means the Lagrangian density must be a scalar density. And furthermore, it has this rather miraculous property that even though it's second order, it gives rise to second order field equations, then you're going to be stuck with the Hilbert action. So this is a way of actually seeing that the Hilbert action is basically unique. It's the unique action, second order action, that gives you second order field equations. Up to, of course, a term which you might call the cosmological constant, which is nice that it's there, because you will want, in general, to introduce a cosmological constant. Now, there's a stronger version of this theorem due to Grigori, and I wonder if any of you are aware of this theorem. I haven't worked through it myself. It's very, very, it's a very tough proof. I just wondered if anyone was aware of it. Here, the claim is, if you start with a quasi-invariant action, that's to say, an action that's invariant up to a surface term, which is first order in derivatives of G mu nu, and supposing that the action is built only of G mu nu and its derivatives, and this is a very important assumption in both cases. Okay, assuming that the Lagrangian depends only on G mu nu and its derivatives, not some other field, like a vector field or a scalar field, then you're going to end up with the Einstein gamma-gamma action uniquely up to a cosmological constant. I'm assuming that theorem is correct, but I haven't worked through the proof. Finally, let's look at the case of pure gravity. Let's start with just a general Lagrangian density that, again, as before, we're assuming depends on G mu nu and its first and maybe second derivatives. And we're looking at arbitrary transformations of the coordinates, so arbitrary diffeomorphisms, where, of course, this variation in the coordinates may depend on space and time smoothly. We're looking at infinitesimal variations, and therefore we're imposing this as a symmetry on the action in the sense of Noether. Then it turns out that the Noether conditions for the quasi-invariance of this action are given by this identity. Remember, I'm not imposing on any conditions on the on-shell conditions. E mu nu here is the variational derivative of this Lagrangian with respect to the inverse of G mu nu. Okay? So it's the Euler expression for G mu nu. And it's going to be multiplied by the covariant derivative of G mu nu, and this is going to be equal to this is divergence here, a covariant divergence. And because in general relativity we have metric compatibility, that's to say the covariant derivative of G mu nu vanishes, we end up with this identity, which should look more or less familiar. This is again the variational derivative. It's the covariant divergence of the variational derivative of the action with respect to G mu nu is vanishing. Now, we can either plug the Hilbert action in here, or we can use the Einstein action. The gamma-gamma action, it doesn't matter, because they're the same up to a divergence. And we end up getting, of course, that our variational derivative is equal to the famous Einstein act, the Einstein tensor, where it's r mu nu minus 1/2 r g mu nu. And what do we end up getting? We end up getting the covariant divergence of the Einstein tensor vanishes identically, because we haven't put any on-shell conditions yet. But we already knew that. These are just the twice-contracted Bianchi identities. We shouldn't be surprised that we're getting out a mathematical identity, because that's what we meant in the first place by an identity. Or is it? Well, I'm gonna end this session just by putting up the following quotes. Does general covariance explain the Bianchi identity? There's a book by Infeld and Plobansky, Motion and Relativity from 1960. I just draw your attention to these remarks. On page 42, one could ask, what is the source of the twice-contracted Bianchi identities? The answer is, they follow from the covariant character of Einstein's tensor and from the existence of a variational principle leading to Einstein's tensor. We shall prove the identities in such a way as to exhibit the reason for their validity, covariance with respect to all transformations. And on page 44, once they've done the proof, which is just essentially what I went through. The proof also shows the character of the Bianchi identities. They are the consequence of the invariance of the gravitational action. That is, they are the consequence of the temporal character of the theory, which is covariant with respect to all transformations. Now, a similar remark is made by Robert Wald in his famous textbook, General Relativity. The Bianchi identity may be viewed as a consequence of the invariance of the Hilbert action under diffeomorphisms. Does that make sense? Isn't the Bianchi identity just a mathematical identity? Surely it's going to hold even if you didn't know anything about an action approach to general relativity. It's just an identity. It's a theorem within Riemannian geometry, is it not? In what sense are we deriving it? What we're really doing in this proof is the following. I just want to make a distinction between two things. This Lagrangian, its specific form is not specified. I'm simply imposing a constraint on this action principle by way of the Noether condition. I'm simply saying, even before we apply Hamilton's principle, which allows us to derive that this thing is equal to zero, those are just the vacuum field equations. Even before you apply Hamilton's principle, we're going to assume that action has a symmetry. That's to say, there are variations that leave this thing invariant up to a surface term. That allows us to infer this identity. But the word identity here simply means it's a constraint on that Lagrangian. But I don't know what the Lagrangian is. But the minute you put in a specific Lagrangian, what you're going to end up with is a mathematical identity you knew anyway. And the fact that this holds is a fact simply in Riemannian geometry. It's just it just follows from the very nature of these particular tensors. So it's not, in a sense, it's not that we're explaining this in general. This is true willy-nilly. It's just that we know we're going to expect, once we specify a form for that Lagrangian, we're going to expect to see a mathematical identity appear, and it just so happens that in this case it's the twice contracted Banach difference. But it seems to me very peculiar to say that we're deriving it, or we're providing a source, or let's say a basis for it. It's true willy-nilly. So if it's okay, we'll stop for, let's say, 10 minutes, and then I'll make a few more remarks about how Einstein used the Noether result in understanding general relativity.